And that was Jennifer Kemp speaking with journalist Lou Jurenik about his book, The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. Speaking about the Armenian Genocide, a bright and cheerful topic for a bright and cheerful morning on KBOO Portland. Coming up, Follow the Garbage, a look at what happens to the stuff we throw out. That was produced by KBU alum Lisa Loving with a crew of volunteers. That's right. This is volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio. So if you are not yet a member of the KBU Foundation, why not join up right now? KBOO.fm. Click where it says Donate Today. And now, let's follow that garbage.
Hello, my name is Lisa Loving from KBU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, and you're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases stories and other radio productions from community radio stations around the country. Today on Sprouts, Follow the Garbage, an exploration of exactly what happens to the stuff we throw out. Stay tuned.
I know I'm dirty and everything, but I just want to talk to you just a minute. I just want a little bit of your time.
Hey, girl. I am your garbage man.
I'm Lisa Loving with KBU Community Radio. A crew of KBU News reporters has interviewed experts around the nation to find out more about trash and its impacts on our neighborhoods and our planet. A couple of us even went to the local dump. This is our special report. We're looking at our garbage flow, why it is the way it is, what gets recycled and what doesn't, and what you can do to reduce the waste in our waste. First up, Jim Ivancy and Josh Childs got kicked out of the Metro Solid Waste Repository the first time they went, so they piled into Jim's old pickup truck for a second try.
Gotta get it in your hand. I am your garbage man.
And here we go. This is Josh. And we are passing down the road, passing down bus stops.
Oh, they will.
Okay, they're going to let us in. We're going to, like, tell you a live description of everything we see.
Yeah, you breathe a lot of different chemicals coming here, that's for sure. And when you're in there, you should almost wear a dust mask, because if they're not always running the conveyor belt, but if they are, it stirs a lot of dust up. And plus, just people throwing stuff off their trucks or vehicles creates dust, so, and you don't know what's in that dust, so it's always a good idea to wear a dust mask if you really want to. But a lot of people don't, and I'll admit I don't too a lot, so just because you hopefully in there for a short time, but yeah, it's not a bad idea when it's real dusty to wear a dust mask.
So you heard it live from Jim, wear a dust mask. And we were just about at the waste transfer station. We were pulling up on the waste transfer station.
Not only did Jim and Josh not get kicked out of the dump this time, but they were actually given a tour by a guy named Bob. Bob made it clear that he did not want his full name used in this interview.
We're walking into the facility itself.
Right now they're dumping all the produce and recyclable, the organic material that's going to be shipped up to Washington. So it's interesting to see, this is a new experiment, as he just said, so we're watching that be dumped right now.
All right, and it's dumping all sorts of things, lettuce, oranges, boxes, apples. Looks like some more lettuce or cabbage or something. Interesting smell if you've ever smelled organic anything.
When the public customers, when they come in, they do their transaction with the scale person, and then the traffic control really decides where that customer is going to dump. And we ask every customer what they may have in their load. Of course, they all respond, garbage. But to us, it's really not garbage. It could be, we got good garbage and bad garbage here. The good garbage, we try to separate it out. If the public customer is interested in recycling, there's all the different bins that they can use here for basically the curbside items that you put out at your house. If they want to separate their load, we're glad to show them where to put the different the wood or the metals or the different papers they might have or plastic. If they don't want to do that, then they just, if they're in too much of a hurry to bother to try to do the right thing, you know, they just shove it all off the back, and that's okay because they paid to get rid of it. And then our crew will come in and separate the pile that they chose not to recycle the next day, and we try to recycle what they didn't. But if they want to recycle, you know, we got a bunch of different piles. We got the metals and the yard debris, different bins. We got the rebuild it centers here. If you got leftover building supplies that are still good, we can put that on their trailer and they come and pick it up and take it to their store. We have a St. Vincent de Paul trailer here, so we find good books or clothing or a piece of furniture that's still good. We set it at their trailer, and then we load up their trailer, and then it goes down to their store where they try to resell.
Elizabeth Reut is the author of Garbage Land, On the Secret Trail of Trash. It's a memoir. In your book, Garbage Land, you write about household waste in New York City before the invention of dustbins and plastics.
There was a lot less waste. The waste was of a different type. It was more organic. There was a lot of ash from heating stoves and cooking, so there was wood ash. There was very little product waste, packaging, plastic and paper and things. People burned whatever they could. Organic material and food scraps were thrown out to pigs. 150 years ago, we had a lot of pigs on the streets of New York, and they were the garbage collectors. And people would keep pigs in basement tenements, things like that. And there were pig riots in the city, and occasionally the police would round up the pigs. They were a menace to the public. And so garbage accumulated, and it was this accumulation of garbage and the way that it impeded commerce that really organized the first big street cleanups. Businesses couldn't operate. There was so much filth in the street that customers couldn't come in and goods couldn't be delivered. And so it was these merchants who pushed for organized trash collection in New York City.
I was really fascinated with your discussion of just the role that horse-drawn buggies had, the impact that they had on street garbage.
Sure, those horses generated a lot of manure. It had to go somewhere. I guess I wrote a little bit about horses that died in the street also.
Yeah, dead carcasses of horses in the street. And where it all ended up, too. Like
In the river. Those days, yes, right off the end of the piers. And when the space in between the piers filled up, the piers were extended farther out into the river, and so those were early landfills. They were creating new waterfront land with the dumping of trash, but as people realized they were killing oyster beds and there was waste floating in the rivers and impeding commerce again, people dumped it farther and farther out at sea. Colonel George Waring, who organized the first trash pickups, he had teams of sanitation workers. They were dubbed the White Wings, and they had very nice uniforms, and they had carts, and I've seen some great historical pictures of these horse-drawn carts with bins in them, and they just went around sweeping up. It was when the merchants realized that people couldn't get in their stores and they couldn't get goods delivered and move them out that they pressured City Hall to get this filth out of there.
To me, an interesting, just again, big picture turning point in the history of just garbage nationwide was in the 1980s and 1990s, the EPA passed the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, forcing landfills. Essentially, you know, the idea was that they were going to create groundwater protection systems. You write about how the number of local dumps operating across the country really shrank. And looking at how in 1988, there were 8,000 landfills. Mm-hmm. By 1999, there were 2,300 or so. And by 2002, by 6 years ago, there were fewer than 1,800 landfills. And what was your take on why the EPA wanted to do that? And, did it really have that effect, or did it maybe have some other effects that were unintended negative consequences?
I think that the EPA did the right thing. They wanted to protect groundwater. They tightened regulations on landfills. They wanted containment systems for leachate. They didn't want this toxic garbage juice coming out of landfills and contaminating soil and groundwater. And so they required landfills to have these liners on them. But a lot of landfills either couldn't or wouldn't come up to code, and so they closed a lot of the town dumps. And so what you ended up with was much larger landfills. And you have now these regional landfills. You have garbage moving from state to state and from other countries, from Canada and Mexico into the U.S. and also out of the U.S. into Canada and Mexico. Garbage is going long distances. It costs more money to haul it around. And these landfills are hundreds, if not thousands, of acres big. So it's a much more complicated system, and only the biggest companies have the capital to build these places and run them. So the garbage business is in the hands of a very few large corporations.
In garbage land, when the former sanitation commissioner says, you know, in the end, garbage will win, what was your take on that? Do you think garbage is going to win? Is it a big bad guy, or is it us? I don't know. What was your take on that?
I think that what he was saying is that the garbage will win, that it'll keep flowing, and that we just have to keep moving it away. And that seems to be the modus operandi of a lot of city managers. We just have to move it away, away. Let's bury it. Let's get rid of it. But what I learned writing the book is that you can't just bury garbage in a hole in the ground and forget about it. When you bury biodegradable resources, you generate two serious forms of leachate of pollution. And one of them is leachate, and one of them is methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. So I think that we have to learn to generate less waste in the first place. And in the back part of my book, I talk about the zero waste movement and what people are trying to do to reduce waste up front and to work with manufacturers and brand owners to redesign their goods so that they can be repaired and reused and recycled, and that they don't contain toxic materials. And the garbage doesn't have to win. We can change the nature of our garbage, getting toxics out of it, designing goods so that they are made of biodegradable materials so we can compost them, whether it's shampoo bottles or packaging for food or textiles or foam inside our furniture. All these things could be made of biodegradable materials, and that would take a huge chunk out of our waste stream. So I don't think that the garbage has to win. If the garbage were less toxic, that would be a huge step in the right direction, and that seems to be possible with green chemistry. I mean, we're not there yet, but people are working on these things.
One of the things that I had not thought about until I picked up this book was how our relative standard of living, how our ebbing and flowing affluence as a country has a real measurable impact on the waste itself.
Sure. The more money you have, the more stuff you buy and the more stuff you waste. Poor people don't generate as much waste. They don't landscape as much, and they don't renovate and knock down walls and buy all new carpeting and curtains as frequently as other people do. They don't have as many houses. The houses aren't as big, so everything is on a smaller scale. Yeah, I was kind of hoping that the downturn in the economy would show up in the waste flow. We'll see.
Jim and Josh saw what Elizabeth Reut was talking about firsthand at the garbage dump.
This is the commercial area here.
All right, we're heading from the public area into the commercial area.
The only type of hazardous material that we take over here is oil and antifreeze. We'll take oil, antifreeze, and car batteries. If we see something there in that bay that we can recycle, we'll send some machine over to get it out of there to put it to the recycle area.
All right, and we're walking on as we're being followed by a truck. Got tree shrubs, got woods of all kind, cardboards. Looks like old doors, looks like old siding from houses. Ah, another conveyor belt.
So this is our wood area here. All the wood and yard debris that comes in, either source separated by the public or commercial loads that are all wood, or what we pulled out by hand. It gets brought over here, mixed together. We run it through this system here, which grinds it up for hog fuel, which is basically it's good for burning. It goes to the S&P newsprint plant in Newburgh, where they burn it for steam energy to run their facilities. It's what we recycle the most of here, or recover. It's really not recycling because it's only recovered and then burned. But it saves room in the landfill. It's too dirty to do anything else with it besides burn it.
Jim, Josh, and Bob are very excited about the giant conveyor belts at the dump.
All right, and we're walking on. Little lights hanging from the ceiling. Cats coming over. Oh, there goes the conveyor belt, and it's moving, taking the trash.
Some things we recycle that there's still a charge for, like electronics. We can recycle electronics. We have there's a market for them, but we still have it's an item that's still charged for. We can do the carpet pad, concrete rubble, which is very heavy. We can do glass, window glass, hard plastic like kid toys. I've been here 17 years, and for many years we just all that type of kid toy plastic all went up that belt right there. You know, now we have a market for it. We bale it all up. Somebody picking up a tin can or an aluminum can really isn't very cost effective. But, you know, so we're going for the heavier items, you know, cardboard, big pieces of wood. If we find a bag of newspaper or a bag of pop cans or something like that, they're going to grab that up. But stuff that's just all intermingled all over the place, you know, that's going away. That's why it's important to really recycle that at home the right way, you know, because once it gets to the trash, it's really not very easy to recover.
I want to say thank you, Bob, for the tour. Yeah,
thank you very much. Very cool.
No problem.
Yes. And any thoughts that you have on what your job is? Do you just think people can recycle more? Is that correct?
Some people do a great job. I think some other people still need to try a little harder.
All right. Well, that's good to hear.
And teach their kids.
Yes.
You know, to do it. Recycle what they can. Because once it really gets in your trash can, it's very hard to get out.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions from community radio stations across the country. You're listening to Follow the Garbage. The news on trash is not all bad. Reporters Katie Arentz and Ryan White went in search of solutions. They found deconstruction.
Every contractor doing remodeling has to do demolition. It's part of the overall project. It's just one of the phases.
We can salvage all the windows, all the doors, hardware, fixtures, bathroom fixtures, cabinets, hardwood flooring. And then once we take off the roof, we can start salvaging sheathing, skip sheathing, plywood sheathing, whatever was used. We can salvage all the framing lumber, siding, all the way down to the foundation, to the crawl space. My name is Durr Lovett, the owner of Lovett Deconstruction Incorporated. We are a green demolition, if you like. We provide a service for remodeling contractors and new construction contractors. And our emphasis is on salvaging reusable materials.
So here we are at the job, and I guess we'll go in and see how the crew are doing. Check in with Mike, who's running the job.
How's it going? My name is Mike Pallinger, and I work for Lovett Deconstruction. I'm the crew leader for the day for our crew. We're doing different things around the site besides this chimney. I'm hitting the chimney with the sledgehammer to break it apart in small enough pieces that'll fall down the flue. Or I poke the hole so that'll have a nice pile there and protected the walls so that it can make a nice pile and it won't ricochet and break windows and smash people and walls and stuff. I didn't know how it was going to be constructed until I opened it up. I thought maybe it was, you know, from the outside that it was just all full. But it seems like once you get past that facade, it's a lot of loose stuff, you know. And a lot of these things are just whole bricks, so some of them will get smashed or nicked falling down, but there's a lot of salvage here.
The most rewarding part of what we do, for me, is doing an entire house by hand, disassembling an entire house by hand. And salvaging all this beautiful, beautiful material. You know, a house that was built 1910, 1920. It's making way for some new construction, but we can get in there and take it down by hand, denail all the material and get it out there into the marketplace and get it reused. That's very, very rewarding.
KABU reporter Don Wolf spoke with Dr. Marcus Erickson, who's currently working to document and study the giant floating sheen of plastic garbage in the Pacific Ocean.
I'm the Director of Education and Research for the Algolita Marine Research Foundation. And for 10 years, we've traveled from Hawaii back to Los Angeles and L.A. to Hawaii, surveying the amount of plastic trash that's accumulating in the North Pacific Ocean. Now, the North Pacific Ocean is like a giant toilet bowl, twice the size of the United States, that never flushes. And plastic trash that leaves the Pacific Rim, countries like Japan, China, United States, Canada, Mexico, all the plastic trash is building up in the North Pacific at an alarming rate.
And it is actually building up near the United States, closer than any of the other countries you mentioned. Is that correct?
Our study area is roughly 1,000 miles off the coast of California. But the North Pacific Gyre, this swirling mass of clockwise flowing currents, is roughly twice the size of the United States. So in our study area, 1,000 miles off the coast, we're finding that the accumulation has increased about fivefold in the last 10 years.
And you kind of described it as being kind of like a toilet bowl effect. So what you're saying is this garbage is actually moving around the rim of this circular motion throughout the whole Pacific, even near the Asian coast, is that correct?
Yes. So it extends from, I'd say, Hawaii is in the path of it, about 500 miles off the California coast to 200 miles off the coast of Japan. That entire swath of ocean, roughly 7,000 to 8,000 miles across, is this very slow-moving clockwise currents where plastic debris accumulates. And we're guessing around 3.5 million tons of trash is out there right now.
These things in there, specifically the plastic, are things that are not biodegradable. They're not breaking down in the water. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's not biodegradable. It does break apart by UV light, but it breaks apart into smaller plastic particles. The individual plastic polymers, the molecule of plastic, it's fairly stable. We turn the oceans into, I call it a plastic soup, is the best analogy. It isn't really an island of plastic. It's more like a very thin soup that stretches across the entire ocean.
And so this plastic, if it was not in the ocean, if it was out of there, it could be recycled. But the problem here is going to be gathering it up and collecting it and bringing it to a place where it can be recycled. Is that true?
I cannot foresee any technological fix to remove the plastic that's in the ocean. It's like trying to sift the Sahara or trying to pull a handful of pepper grains from a salad as big as a Rose Bowl. It's really spread out. I think I like people to really get that this North Pacific gyre is twice the size of the United States. It's like trying to vacuum our country for cigarette butts using a vacuum cleaner. It's impractical. The solution is to simply stop putting in more of this non-biodegradable waste. The single-use disposable plastics, like the petroleum-based plastic forks and couplets and plastic bags and water bottles and water bottle lids, those things, they have to go.
And even though the effort is being made to recycle and more people are getting involved in trying to put things into their recycle bin and getting it to the companies that are doing this, is that the problem, or is this coming from another place?
Well, the problem and the solutions are that they come from all areas. The consumer is responsible. Our communities are responsible. The industry that makes plastic and the producers who manufacture plastic products, we all have a stake in this. We're all responsible for this garbage patch. So the consumer needs to cut back. I mean, it'd be nice for the consumer to stop using disposable plastics, to use one water bottle one time and then throw it away, discard it, even try to recycle it, is still a culture of consumption. We still have very poor return rates for recyclables. It'd be nice to see the plastics industry look for alternatives, maybe even go back to glass and paper. Paper is not the best solution either. The best solution is just to bring your own bags, your own water bottles, your own coffee mugs, things that my grandparents did 50 years ago. I've seen grandmothers still pushing carts in the grocery store. I've seen people bringing their own thermos bottles still. Those ideas that worked for this country 50 years ago are what we need to do now to stop this plastic plague in the ocean.
And besides that, besides just getting away from plastics entirely and recycling everything we're using to carry our liquids and our groceries and things like that, there was a bill here in Oregon to expand the deposit, and part of that deposit would be included plastic water bottles. But that failed, and the industry put in quite a bit of money to lobby the legislature here to not do that. Are these part of the problems, is with our politicians really not standing up for us to stop this problem?
Well, the industry is they're very powerful. If you consider how much plastic we produce in the United States, 15 years ago we made roughly 60 billion pounds of plastic in the U.S. alone. And now, 15 years later, we're making 120 billion pounds of plastics. We've doubled production in just 15 years. It's very profitable, and the industry doesn't want to stop making the stuff. So every time I go speak to a state senate or a city council hearing, there's always the American Chemistry Council or Plastic Bag Alliance that's standing behind me getting equal time to speak about why we need to continue using petroleum-based plastics. So they have a very powerful lobby. I'm not sure, I'd be hesitant to say that their interests are the same as yours and mine, but they're able to convince our policymakers that if we don't continue making plastic products, that we're going to lose jobs. People aren't going to want to do it anyway because of the inconvenience of glass and metal and paper. And their arguments are very weak, but their motives are very clear.
It is basically the petroleum-based plastics that are causing the problem. So for an example, if we were to switch to biodegradable plastics, is that going to help solve part of this problem?
Plant-based plastics like PLA and PHA, although they are they're a different product. They do biodegrade. They do not biodegrade so well in the marine environment. They do great in an industrial size, let's say a city-sized compost bin, where it's very hot, it's warm, it's moist and full of microbes. Their bioplastics decompose. In the marine environment, not so. The best solution, once again, is to bring your own cloth bag, bring your own coffee mug, your own water bottle.
So absolutely, the only solution here to stop this growing amount of garbage is to stop using plastics entirely.
Sure. Every single coastline I've been to is inundated with plastics, some more than others, depends on the currents and the wind. But every coastline, I mean, our signature for this age of civilization is plastic. I'd call it the plasticine, because we are creating a layer of plastic around the world. And it's if you look at what's available, the alternatives are there. I mean, we should use the precautionary principle. We know that that's a huge environmental impact. There's also a potential human health impact that I think people should know about. Plastic marine debris, once out in the ocean, it becomes a sponge for many kinds of toxins like PCBs and pesticides and oil drops from cars. Those pollutants stick to plastic at really high concentrations. And we're finding that up to 300 species so far have been found to ingest plastic. We're finding now the current research is when an animal eats plastic particles, thinking it's food typically, does that pollution that sticks to it migrate from the plastic back into the organism? And then does that pollution bioaccumulate up the food chain onto your dinner plate? Is it in your sushi? That's the next question. Is there a human health issue attached to this? We have this conception that we can throw things away. And the reality is there is no away. It goes somewhere. The trash goes somewhere. Half of plastic produced in the United States goes to municipal landfills. The 20% goes to durable goods, things that might last for 5-10 years, like computers or circuit boards, car bumpers, which may go to landfill anyway. Only 5% gets recycled. 25%, what's left behind, is unaccounted for, and we're finding it in our oceans, on our beaches.
Oh, your pots and pans, save up every little thing you can.
You've been listening to Follow the Garbage, a KABU News special report featuring Suzanne LeGrand, Beth Crawford, Richard Umania, Don Wolf, Katie Arendts, and Ryan White. I'm Lisa Loving. Thanks for being with us. That's it for Sprouts this week. You've been listening to Follow the Garbage. Production assistance by Nico Cimino and Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. And if you or someone you know would like to broadcast their story on Sprouts, then contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. Once again, I'm Lisa Loving from KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, and thanks for listening to Sprouts. See you next week. Yeah.
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 11:59 a.m. Coming up as we switch into the, as we cross the meridian from ante into post-meridian. At 12 noon, we've got the headline news at noon, followed by Moving On with your inestimable host, the inimitable, the very amicable, and gosh darn, what a swell guy, Don Jacobson. And now, this. KBOO is a co-sponsor of the Double Mountain Brewery and Tap Room's Great Bottle Roundup and Street Party on Sunday, August 23rd in Hood River. To lower their environmental impact, Double Mountain is working to reuse their bottles. More information about participating in the bottle bring back may be found at their website, doublemountainbrewery.com. Jeff Allworth kicks things off at 11:15 for a talk and signing of his book, The Beer Bible. From noon to 6 p.m., there will be music provided by Left Coast Country, Green Neck Daredevils, and Mile Marker 6. People that bring back bottles for the Bottle Roundup have a chance to win prizes throughout the day. That's on Sunday, August 23rd in Hood River. More information is available on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, August 21st. For KBOO News, I'm Kristen Yount. Of well over 100 water wells tested this year in and around the Nahata Sizil chapter of the Navajo Nation near Sanders, Arizona, showed that some residents have been using water